Continuing in the theme of strengthening the union, we're going to have a panel, a discussion panel around this issue. And this will be chaired by Jonathan Bell, another one of our MLAs from Strangford. So, Jonathan, I'm handing over to you. You can introduce your team. Most of them are known, but it's over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lord Morrow. Ian Paisley Jr., Member of Parliament, needs no introduction, son of our former distinguished leader. Dr. Tom Hennessy, who last we were at Queen's together, I think in 1989. He's a reader in history at Canterbury Christ Church and has written on Northern Ireland. And the Right Honourable Geoffrey Donaldson, Member of Parliament for Lagan Valley. I think we'll take the first question, please.
Thank you. How can unionism in Northern Ireland increase its support outside its traditional base while retaining its base?
Dr. Hennessy, how can unionism do that?
Well, I think some of you will be aware that Lord Philip Gould died recently, and in his tribute to Philip Gould, Alistair Campbell stated that what Gould offered was strategic vision. And Campbell emphasised that this is something that's quite rare in politics. And I think part of the problem that unions have had in the past has been that it's been very tactical and hasn't had a strategic vision for itself. I think the speech today we heard from the First Minister was quite an extraordinary speech in articulating something, a strategic vision for unionism and for the future and how to strengthen it. And I think unionism, and I am a unionist, and I am a unionist because unionism to me is about pluralism. It is about not only that I am an Englishman, but also British. It is a national identity, but it is about being part of a state that recognises different sorts of identities, aspirations, and indeed rights and privileges and so on. And the United Kingdom is, there's nothing quite like the United Kingdom historically that's been created in terms of a union state. If you look at Scotland, the only thing that Scotland ever lost in joining the union in 1707 was its parliament. It was allowed to retain its own identity in many respects and gives us an example of how the union itself can accommodate these different sorts of multitude of identities and so on. I'd just like to say that unionism now, I would say, thanks to the Belfast Agreement and subsequently the St Andrews Agreement, is stronger than ever before. The partition is copper fastened. There is no threat to the union in the short term. It's the longer term I think unionists have to think about. And here we're talking, when I mentioned strategic vision and thinking about the future. And by that I mean that unionism has to think about how in the future Catholics can feel comfortable enough to be part of unionist parties. It's going to be a long process. It involves thinking about, and partly I think Catholics themselves have changed. We've seen the survey data where there's been a collapse in support amongst Catholics for a united Ireland. It's not just economic. It's part of also some of the bitter pills I think unions have had to accept in some of the changes that have occurred over the last few years and so on. But it does mean that Catholics, whether their perceptions originally were correct or incorrect, don't feel second-class citizens. I'm not saying that they were or anything like that. What I'm saying is the perception changes. And that's an opportunity for unionism. It's an opportunity for unionism in the long term to reach out and guarantee the union, not just for my lifetime, but far beyond it. And I think that's what we've got to think about, a civic unionism and articulating a civic unionism. And I think we can learn something from people like, if I may say, John Hume. And Hume, if you look at Hume, Hume talked about an agreed Ireland. Now, I've seen the documents when Hume's been talking to Irish civil servants in the 70s and into the 80s, and it's quite clearly a united Ireland. But people outside in the mainland, in America, are desperate to actually hear something positive in a world where it seemed that things were looking troubled. And unionism can do that, and not by compromising its principles, its basic principles at all, but talking about pluralism, and that this is a society that is comfortable for all. And I would just say Catholics, for example, aren't necessarily nationalists. That's a myth. If you go back to Home Rule or whatever in those periods and so on, Home Rule, for me as a historian, teaches me that it's a point where people like John Redmond, etc., who were leading nationalism at the time before republicanism came along, where people were prepared to accept a relationship within the union. Nationalists were prepared to accept within the United Kingdom and be British. And I think that's something that ultimately in the long term that will take time, but it's part of reaching out. And if we want to secure...
Tom, I think there's steps that we need to take to get to that point. I agree. I think, look, there's a maxim in all of this. Without a vision, people perish. Our party has provided today a very powerful vision. A vision that should enliven people, should give them hope, and a vision that should say, that's where we want to go. That's the direction we want to go in. Now, how do we do it? I think there's practical steps. The grassroots level, first of all, every public representative, from whether it's council right the way through to Europe, has a responsibility to work, to deliver for ordinary people, to give them what they want, and to show that politics in this new era of normality is incredibly boring, and we can only make it real for them if we deliver for them on practical terms, i.e. they have a problem with their housing executive, we sort it out. They have a problem with planning, we help them get to a solution. They have a problem in their local business, we help them. And taking those genuine day-and-day steps, that's how we show through real work that we are a normal political party doing the real work for everyone who comes through our constituency door. And the biggest disadvantage we have is something which Peter put his finger on, that's complacency. Complacency within our own ranks, complacency within the general public. And I understand why it's there. We do not have an opposition against us because we're so big, and I'm delighted about that in one sense. We do not have an opposition internally because we're so united. The only opposition we actually get is in the media. And the media's opposition is not genuine electoral-based opposition, i.e. they've got a different vision from ours, and it's a clash of ideas. The reason why we've got such a difficult opposition is because it's just all negative. Everything's negative. I'll give you two examples. Yesterday on the news, the fifth headline on the BBC News was 166 new jobs in West Belfast. It was the sixth headline, yet it should have been the first headline because it was the most important announcement. It was a positive story. This week I did a calculation on our national and local media about positive to negative stories. For every one positive story that appeared in your newsletter, in your Irish News, in your Belfast Telegraph, on the BBC, on the national papers, for every one positive story, there was 18 negative stories. 18. Now, you can't fight those odds. And that's what's really turning the public off. So the media have a responsibility in all of this as well.
Geoffrey Nolson, how do we build our base?
I think I would endorse has been said here, but I would add something to it. I think for us as a party, the greatest challenge we face is how, at one level, we reach out and engage more with people from a Catholic background, and at the same time, reconnect with working-class Protestants, two-thirds of whom do not bother to come out and vote. And I think that is, for the DUP, something that we need to look at and examine very carefully. How do you broaden the base of unionism while on the one hand, yes, absolutely, doing what Tom has identified we need to do. Ian is right in terms of engaging with people. I've noticed a marked difference over the last, I would say, 5 years since devolution in the number of people from the Roman Catholic community who come into my office looking for help. It has gone up dramatically over that period of time. And I think people from that background, from a Catholic background, are more comfortable now dealing with unionist politicians.
And in the PR election, Geoffrey, we'll pick up that support. Yes. Which is the benefit of the PR in that?
So I think you know that is happening to a certain extent. But the word of caution I add is that as important as that is in broadening the base of unionism, we need to reconnect with those working class Protestants out there who, for whatever reason, are sitting at home and not coming out to vote. Mm. And I think there's a real challenge because that's the DUP's originally. That is where the DUP emerged from. And I think that is a big challenge for this party.
OK, we'll take our next question, please.
The European Union is certainly trying to take more power and more of our money. My question is, has the mother of all parliaments become a baby sister to Brussels?
Geoffrey, are we the mother of all parliaments, the Imperial Parliament, or are we denuded to... The European Parliament?
Well, I think we still are the mother of all parliaments, but there is no doubt that a large proportion of the laws that are passed today that impact on the United Kingdom have their origins in Brussels. And you talk to people, and I think there is a fatigue now, and especially amongst business. Business is really being held back by this over-regulation, much of which emanates from Brussels. And we as a party have committed ourselves to rolling back regulation. David Cameron talks about renegotiating our links with the European Union. Ian and I think, are both members of the Better Off Out group, so our position is very clear. I was in Norway recently. There's a country that's not in the European Union. It continues to thrive. It's got a good economy. It can stand on its own two feet. Frankly, I'd like to see the United Kingdom back standing on its own two feet and not relying on other countries. The fact is, we're still net contributors. And I'm tired listening to this argument by those who are pro the European Union telling us, look at all the benefits you would lose if you left the EU. Frankly, look at all the benefits we could gain if we left the EU and were able to stand on our own two feet. And I think this crisis in the Eurozone may well be the catalyst. And if David Cameron thinks he's going to be able to renegotiate Britain's relationship with the European Union and that the Germans and French will simply go along with that, I'm not so sure that that is going to be the case. So I think the EU is going to change in the years to come. The question for us will be, will it be a two-speed Europe? Will there be a Europe with France, Germany and some others who are very much at the centre of the European Union with the rest on the periphery? Or do we take the step further and regain our independence and self-determination? And the DUP in Parliament has been very clear. We voted in favour of the people of this country being given a referendum on the question of whether or not we should remain in the EU, and that is our position. I think the people of this country should be given that voice, should be given that say, and the sooner the better.
And there's a ticking clock
on all of this.
Yeah.
You've seen...
Well, Jonathan, I was just going to say that there's a ticking clock in all of this, and that is the actual timing. Cameron has laid out this claim, as Jeffrey's articulated there, that he's going to do something. It's now our opportunity, Britain's opportunity, to do something and to get some powers back. The fact of the matter is, if he doesn't deliver on that promise, and we should keep his toes in the fire in this one, if he doesn't deliver on that, his own backbench will revolt. So, the pressure is on Cameron, Prime Minister, to deliver and to do something on that point. And like Jeffrey, I'd be sceptical that he will be able to against the might of Germany in particular to achieve what he claims he's hoping to achieve.
But are we the junior partner? You've seen the European Parliament, imagine, from both sides, and you're now in the National Parliament. Are we the junior partner to Europe?
I think what we have to do is always make sure that we in the United Kingdom assert our sovereignty and assert our sovereignty for what is best for the United Kingdom, what is best for the British subjects. And we have had governments in the past who have failed to do that. And what we now require, and as I'm saying, the clock is on Cameron to now assert the sovereignty of Britain, or else he, or sort of the United Kingdom, or he will end up in serious trouble within his own party. And I hope he does do that, but I wouldn't be putting money on it.
Tom, you're a distinguished historian. Have we let slide from the British Parliament to Europe, put ourselves in a subservient position?
I think we have, but I'm agnostic on the European Union. I haven't made my mind up whether we should be in or out. What I do feel, though, is that Britain still is a big player in the world. And I think we have to remember why we went in. One of the key reasons we went into the European Union is because the world, when we were trying to get in, well, in the 60s and got in the 70s, was a bipolar world of superpowers. The Soviet Union, the United States, that's gone. We're now in a multipolar world. And the idea that Europe on its own as an entity was a way of maintaining British influence, I think, doesn't hold up in the same way as it did in the past. What you have to remember, I think, is that, Mr. Cameron is a Eurosceptic, but having seen the documents that previous prime ministers have been put in front of him, he will be getting from civil servants the impression that British influence will decline considerably if Britain were to pull out of the EU. That's why we won't get a referendum, because it's one thing to be outside saying these sort of things, but once you're the Prime Minister and you're faced with the different options and the potential dangers, even if these dangers are not real, a prime minister taking those decisions or in that position would be very much influenced by that.
But position. Europe is in complete disarray politically.
Absolutely.
I mean, its institutions are in disarray. Its leadership is in disarray. And that is a huge opportunity for the United Kingdom to now do what is right.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Yeah. So whether he's up to it.
We got 400... We've access to 400 million, just to provoke the debate, we've access to 400 million people to do business with in the European Union. Most Northern Ireland businesses are looking to Europe to expand. Europe put in nearly €1 billion. Barroso gave us a task force to specifically take projects in Northern Ireland. Are we absolutely sure we're better off out?
Well, most of our businesses actually do business within the United Kingdom. They also export to the Republic of Ireland. What we should be doing is encouraging them to export beyond, not just within Europe, but beyond Europe. There are huge new markets for our agri-food sector in Brazil, in China. That's where we should be looking. That's why Arlene has been very effective in trying to get new licensing agreements, which Europe would prevent us from having, to those countries so that we can sell our powdered milk, one of our wonderful commodities, sell other produce which we're no longer allowed to eat, like meat offal, which is a delicacy in China. They're the things that we should be encouraging expansion of.
Geoffrey, what are you? Are we absolutely sure you'd have been there at the time of the Barroso Task Force and the goodwill of Europe to Northern Ireland were fighting for a peace for?
I mean, in fairness to the EU, they have been, they've made a positive contribution in terms of the peace process, but I think we've got to look beyond that, and I feel that Europe has reached a stage of bureaucracy, a level of bureaucracy, where it hinders business more than it helps business.
Sure.
And I agree entirely with Ian. Look, our biggest competitors in the next 10 years are going to be China, not Germany or France. Our biggest opportunities in terms of markets are beyond the European Union. So, if Norway can survive in the European Union or outside the European Union, but survive in Europe, I think the UK is more than capable of doing that. And we've got something Norway doesn't have. We've got the Commonwealth and the links that we have with those nations right across the world. So, no, it doesn't intimidate.
And Norway has implemented something like 3,000 pieces of European legislation in less than 52 acts. So we over-legislate because of Europe.
Well, let's look to Scotland and question number three, please.
With the rise of the Scottish National Party, the appeal of Alex Salmond, and the disarray of the Tories, Labour and Liberal Democrats, has Scotland become the weakest link in the Union?
Ian Junior, your father was on the boat yesterday with Alex Salmond, did a good relationship, worked well for Northern Ireland. What do you think?
Look, I think we've got to be absolutely clear about this. The current part of our nation that is under threat from leaving the Union is Scotland. Ulster is safe. We've helped secure that. We've endorsed that. But Scotland is now where we were a few years ago, on the edge of the Union. Largely because Scotland does not feel loved within the Union or embraced within the Union. And I think that the people and the peoples that have as much responsibility to do something about this happen to be the English. I think the English have a responsibility to no longer treat the Scots as the Scots would be better off without them. They have to have an assertive campaign that shows that Scotland is cherished. It's an integral part of the Union. The Union would be poorer without it, poorer culturally, poorer spiritually, poorer economically, poorer socially. It's got to make sure that that case is made. And at the moment, I do not hear any Englishman or Englishwoman of standing making that case. And yet if it happens, because again of complacency, this Union, which we're in, will then be under threat again. And we will see that the Northern Ireland question will then be reasserted by Republicans and Nationalists here. So we have something significant to gain by ensuring that we push our English brothers and sisters to embrace the Scottish Union and see that Scotland feels as cherished as being part of the Union as we now know we have made our place in the Union.
Geoffrey.
I think I would want to jump in here in defence of the English to a certain extent. The English taxpayer subsidises Scotland and Northern Ireland to a very substantial amount, and we need to recognise that. And there is an issue in England emerging where people are beginning to say, well, we're subsidising these other parts of the kingdom, and they're having a say in our affairs, and you get the West Lothian question. I think the difficulty in Scotland is the failure of the Scottish Labour Party and the Scottish Conservative Party to advocate and to promote the benefits of the union. And if you take the Scottish Labour Party, which is the largest party in opposition to the Scottish Nationalists, they send all their major, all of their senior politicians are in Westminster. Now, we as a party took a decision that we would split our talents and our abilities between Stormont and Westminster, ensuring that we had a strong voice in our national parliament, but equally we had a strong team in the Northern Ireland Assembly as well. And I think the Scottish Labour Party has got this badly wrong in terms of, if you look at the people and the team they have in the Scottish Parliament, not terribly impressive. The Scottish Nationalist Party in Scotland is impressive. Whatever you think of Alex Salmond, he's an impressive operator. Yeah. He comes across well. Scottish Labour have no one of the standing of Alex Salmond. And right now, people in Scotland are enjoying the type of devolution that the SNP are delivering. I think, though, when it comes to a referendum, the Scottish people will still vote to remain within the union. But I think there's a challenge for our Conservative friends. And in the recent leadership contest in the Scottish Conservative Party, Murdo MacLeod, who is a pretty impressive figure in my opinion, he lost the leadership contest, but he put forward a proposal that I felt was the answer for the Conservatives and Unionists in Scotland. That was to have what we have here, a Unionist party, a Scottish Unionist party, based in Scotland, acting on behalf of the Scottish people, but perhaps affiliated to the National Conservatives. Unfortunately, that was rejected, and the people in Scotland regard the Scottish Conservatives as little more than the English version with a kilt, and it just doesn't work. So I think that the challenge now is to create a unionist movement across the United Kingdom. And we in the DUP, I think, should be at the forefront of challenging our fellow unionists in other parts of the kingdom. We should not underestimate the threat that is there from nationalism in Wales and Scotland. Ian is right. If Scotland were to take itself out of the union, that has consequences for all of us. So I think that what we want to see, and the challenge for David Cameron here as the Prime Minister, he talks a good game as a unionist, but so far he hasn't followed through. And I think we would like to see the Conservatives looking again at how they operate in Scotland. I think Scottish Labour should be looking at how they operate in Scotland. It's time somebody took Alex Salmond on, and right now neither of those parties have stepped up to the mark.
Tom, you're going to have the last word in this matter.
Okay.
Big responsibility in an Englishman.
It is. I think the greatest danger to the Union is English ambivalence, because the English tend to think of Great Britain and, by extension, the British Isles as Greater England.
True.
It's an accident of the fact that of the 60 plus million people in the UK, 47 million or more are actually English. It's a way, you know, that when the unions occur between Ireland and Scotland, Westminster remained. That impression and understanding or map image of the country and so on has remained. I think it's. Scotland is a complicated situation. I don't think necessarily the fact that there's a nationalist party in power automatically means the union is on the way out. There are plenty of other examples historically where nationalist parties have attained power but and opposed the constitutional framework existing, yet the constitution itself has survived and continued. I think Cameron's problem is that they don't want to play the SNP's game. And the SNP's game is, what they hoped was, there was a Conservative government in London, and by the time, with the Celtic Tiger still going strong, and Iceland not having collapsed and so on, Scotland was a proposition for independence. And with an English government in the south, across the border, they could play on that English interference. And I think that's the one thing that stopped the Conservative Party and government interfering and being stronger on the union. Yeah. And I agree, it is up to the unionists in Scotland to actually assert themselves.